It is such a delight and pleasure to welcome our guest for this evening. Ken McLeod was a guest on our radio show, The Mystical Positivist, a few months ago. It was a real pleasure to be in conversation with someone who has such depth of experience in dedication to spiritual practice. The spiritual practice that he the tradition he works in is not one that I have deep familiarity with, and nevertheless, there was, it seemed to me, a meeting that transcended the differences between our different traditions. That is a wonderful thing. And it only happens, in my experience, when people's self-examination practice proceeds to a depth and level that is rare. So, of course, he is the author of a number of wonderful books that I've had the opportunity to read some of, but not all, and he will be here to sign those later this evening. But I really encourage you to join me in welcoming Ken McLeod, Many Rivers Books.
Thank you, Rob. By the way, it's Rob's birthday today, so.
Happy birthday.
I don't like giving talks particularly, so I'd like to approach this evening as a conversation. And I'm extremely comfortable with you throwing up questions at any point. Rob and I were chatting beforehand, and he was telling me how much study he'd done of sutras, both in the Pali and the Mahayana traditions. And the word sutra, some of you may not know, is derived from the same root as the word suture. And it has the meaning in Sanskrit of two things being brought together. In the case of sutra, it's always described as this is the meeting of the mind, the minds of the student and teacher, of two minds coming together, and that's only done if there's actual conversation rather than just a one-way communication. Nothing is actually, can't be sure that anything is met in that circumstance. Tibetan chose the word do for sutra. The word means cross, it's the same as the word for crossroad, so you have two roads coming together. So that's what I would like to work towards this evening, is some possibility of actually coming together and through exchange of questions and things you may be curious about. Before we get into the actual book, a couple of things. One is I have a notoriously soft voice, so if at any point it goes below the threshold of hearing, please do something suitably frantic to get my attention, and I will try to raise it up to the point of audibility again. The second thing I'd like to do before we start is to, there's some thank yous, first to Rob and Stuart for hosting this event at this bookstore, to Odin back there who runs, I think, Jim somewhere also. Lovely space, it's very nice, really appreciate you making the effort to do this. Second, and this is a long overdue thanks, Valerie, you going to stand up? No? Yes. Valerie is a wonderful book designer, and she designed the last two books that I published, and she's wonderful to work with, ultra organized, and just delivers a beautiful, well thought out design that is in keeping with the themes and the feeling of the book. So thank you very much, Valerie. And then there's Donna. Where are you? You're hiding there. Donna represents the organization Unfettered Mind. She's on the board of directors. And these are a group of people that have provided me with support over the last years. Donna and I go back actually to 1971. We met in a at a Buddhist mission outside Delhi. We've kept in touch over all of these years. So with that, I'm just going to start in. Now, as I said, please feel free to pose any questions. One of the things that many people are curious about at these kinds of events is, why did you write this book? I had a couple of intentions, but the actual idea for the book came after I finished Reflections on Silver River, which is a commentary on a very famous and much loved poem in the Tibetan tradition called the 37 Practices of the Bodhisattva. And one of the websites that had reviewed the book said, Ken happens to be very good at providing contemporary commentaries to ancient verses. I read that and said, I think he's right. and I realized it's something that I do. I've done a lot in my own teaching because I'm primarily a translator. So I'm taking this from one cultural context and trying to put it into another cultural context, which is not always the easiest thing to do. And the theme of Reflections on Silver River, which is the book on the 37 practices, is very much compassion, which was a very, very important theme in Tomei Zongpo's own life. And so I felt that in keeping with the basic Mahayana principle that you have compassion, or you have means and wisdom, or compassion and emptiness, these two together, it would be good to take another poem in which the theme was principally the awareness or the wisdom aspect. And I couldn't think, there's all kinds of poems I could have chosen, but one that was especially meaningful to me had been given to me to translate by Kelin Rinpoche in 2003 when I completed a retreat with him. The theme was Dzogchen, and I taught the text myself a few years later, and so I sat down and basically retranslated and wrote this commentary. And so now I feel that you have the two sides of the coin. One is the compassion, one is the wisdom side. So you have to have both books. And one of my favorite Stephen Colbert report, the Colbert Report, was when he had Kermit the Frog on. And he could do this. He was interviewing Kermit because Sesame Street was putting out a new book or something like that. And every 3 minutes in the interview, Kermit would turn to the camera and say, buy the book. That was just so delightfully honest. So, I'm not going to try to get into what is Dzogchen or anything like that. That would take us all night. But what I do want to say is that as I've been thinking about my relationship with Buddhist practice over the last many, many years, really, but the last few years, it struck me more and more that it's really about mysticism. And for some reason or other, people have avoided using that word in connection with Buddhist practice, almost as if it's a hot potato. And yet, when I look back on my own experience, it was the possibility of mystical understanding or mystical knowledge which first attracted me or drew me into Buddhist practice. There's just no question of that. I've read books such as The Three Pillars of Zen back in the 60s. It was very difficult in Canada, yet it was very difficult to get hold of anything. I've read accounts of various Christian mystics, particularly Thomas Merton, the Desert Fathers, which I found, The Desert Fathers by Thomas Merton. And that was very, very much my motivation. And I think it's particularly important today because almost everybody I know who now gets involved in Buddhist practice is doing so because they think it's going to help them with their lives. And they're looking for some benefit out of it. And That, I think, is very unfortunate. In fact, I think it's more than unfortunate. From my perspective, it's virtually a blasphemous motivation. It is so contrary to what the actual point of these teachings are. I wrote both of these books, but particularly this one, from that perspective. And I advise people in the introduction to say, I was really taking a cue from Dorothy Parker, who once said, "This is not a book to be tossed aside lightly. It is to be hurled with great force." if your intention is that you should read this book and it's going to benefit you in your life some way, then throw this book away. Get rid of this book as quickly as you can, because it won't. If it has any effect on your life, it'll just make it far more problematic than you ever wanted to. Another question many people ask me about books is, what's it like writing a book? And to this, it's very simple. I do not enjoy writing, I enjoy having written. The actual writing process for me is very, very difficult. As more than one person has said, it's very simple. You just sit out down at your desk and you wait for blood to pour from your forehead. I find it very, very difficult. And I've often wondered why I find it so difficult. But many of the other writers I've talked to have reported the same thing. They have different difficulties, but one of the main ones for me is always, it's very easy for me to take thoughts and have them come out here. It's extremely difficult for me to take thoughts and have them come out here. But that's what you have to do with writing. It's a completely different set of muscles, or to use the modern jargon, neurological patterns and so forth. But there are certain things that you can do in writing that you cannot do in speaking. And one is, you can write far more densely than you can speak. And this is not a way to write long books. The way I approach things is, why take a page when you can say it in a paragraph? Why take a paragraph when you can say it in one sentence? So I try to be as concise and as to the point as possible. Which means that, in my first book, Wake Up to Your Life, some people would show me their copies and they would literally have highlighted whole pages. Which doesn't, so there's a problem with that too. What to do with a book like this? Well, this is a practice book. I have very deliberately not translated this scholastically. The scholastic audience is a particular audience. They're interested in language. They're interested in precision. There seems to be a tendency to prefer a more literal translation, as if there is something sacred about the books. I've eschewed that way of translating because for me, the intention is, Jigme Lingpa, who's the author of the poem that I worked from, he was concerned with communicating an experience. And when I read this poem in Tibetan, I have a certain experience. And when I translate it to the best of my ability, I'm trying to write it in English in such a way that the reader has an experience somewhat akin to that. That, to me, is the essence of translation. I've read several books on translation, and one author, who's a very famous translator from Spanish into English, says the words that she hates most are, "That is a faithful translation." She knows then that she has failed. Because the language isn't alive and isn't speaking. And we have, in America and in the English-speaking world in general, we have an odd relationship with translation. In Europe, people will buy books because they're translated by a certain individual. So the translator has a much higher status. Translators in our culture are nothing, and very, very few books. There's another scholar of translation who wrote a book, stole the title I wanted to use for a book myself, called Thanks for All the Fish. How many of you recognize the reference? Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Babel Fish, and all of that. But he notes that there's a kind of hierarchy about which languages are translated into and which languages are translated from. Because English is a global language, virtually the common lingua franca, to use an old phrase, of the world now, very few books are translated from English into other books. Masses of books are translated. Many books are translated from English into other languages, the dominant language. Relatively few, very, very small percentage, are translated into English. So there are masses and masses of world literature on which we are completely missing out because Americans simply will not buy translations, which is very unfortunate. So the other final comment that I'll make about this is that one of the challenges that I found very strange and difficult. I would give a talk and somebody would come up to me afterwards and say, your idea about the middle way is very interesting. And it was just like, my idea about it isn't my idea at all. But one of the things that I've come to appreciate, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, is that the distrust that has developed about the institutions from on which society depends its functioning have led people to distrust anything that seems to be presenting a traditional institutional idea. And so there's far, far more emphasis on personal stories. And people want to hear the personal story. In fact, when I wrote Wake Up Tomorrow Night, that's the editor's HarperCollins said, that's what you have to do, put in your own experience and this like that. I was very, very resistant to that. That was about 15 years ago. In this book, I have included actually a fair amount of my own personal experience, but I hope in a way in which it illustrates the practice of awareness, the practice of meditation, and doesn't dominate it. So let me give you a couple of short readings from this as a way into this book. The poem that Jigme Lingpa wrote, and this is one of probably hundreds of poems that he wrote, this one is divided into three sections. The first section is about the way that we get confused by our conceptual mind, and the second is about the possibility of freedom or the possibility of peace, because I think peace and freedom in this context are almost synonymous. And the third section is about all the mistakes that you can make when you're doing this kind of thing. But one of the comments that has come again and again to me is he seems to be very scornful and dismissive of other approaches to practice. For example, mind itself, originally pure, is like space. As long as you look for it with conceptual tools, you are like a bug encasing itself in its own spit. In your obsession, you turn your back on what is truly meaningful. How worn out you must be, you listeners, from rejecting everything. And people say, well, you know, he's meant to be this great master. Why is he being so critical? Well, this is a form of poetry which we're not used to anymore in the English and American traditions. The way that I read this is that in the course of practice, we latch on to certain things. I know I certainly did. Anyway, this is the one true teaching. Has anybody ever felt that? And you take it in and you hold on to that. But in holding on to that one true teaching, you actually miss a lot of the possibilities which arise when you just let mind rest. Because subtly or not so subtly, you're trying to get your experience to conform to your conceptual understanding of that one true teaching. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing he's criticizing. So he's criticizing the tendencies in ourselves, not in these various schools. He's just using these schools as metaphors. Another example. While mind itself doesn't take up the good or give up the bad. Yeah? That's actually very deep. A meticulous practice of purity acts as an added pollutant. Now, how many of you have been concerned with purity at one stage or another? And as I relate in here, I was so concerned with the absolutely pure functioning, you know, pure ritual, the very complex ritual we did in the second three-year retreat I did, that I inspired the person who was attending the shrine to throw a glass bowl at me with great force. With the forms of dualistic fixation, you distort what is not to. You seek a sublime state where there is nothing to be attained. How elegant you are, you followers of ritual philosophy. So what he's doing here is pointing out the ways that we fixate on particular aspects of practice and miss the whole point in doing so. So he goes through that in the first section. In the second section, I like this verse particularly. Because I am free from the thinking that distorts experience, the evolution of good and evil ends completely. Now, at first glance, that sounds like he's saying there is no karma. How many of you are familiar with the Fox Abbott koan in Zen? Hakuin's Fox. I refer to it in here.
Hakujo.
Yeah, that's right. And because there isn't any escaping karma. Escaping karma is like escaping gravity. Even if you're in outer space, you don't escape gravity. It's just very weak. It's different. So what does he actually mean here? I'll let you read that to find out. He goes on, what are deities, mantras, and absorptions meant to do? I am not a wakefulness that comes from practice. Well, if that doesn't stop you, it's not much it's going to. What are you doing then if you're striving for a wakefulness that doesn't come from practice? That's a big question. And then he goes on, my nature is universal presence. How can seeing come through paths and levels? And a friend of mine said that when he read that line, it just stopped him. Because he was very, very concerned with all of these paths and levels and getting it absolutely right, etc. That Jigme Lingpa here is referring to something else, some other quality of human experience. To give you the flavor of the commentary, I'm just picking something more or less at random here. Yeah, let's do that. The verse is, no origin, nothing there, that's just how it is. Now, as I said earlier, this is a practice text. It's not a philosophical text. Philosophers would go to town on that. No origin, nothing there, that's just how it is, as expressing some kind of philosophical truth. No, he's describing an experience. And the experience is very simple. When your mind becomes completely quiet, and you look, you do not see anything. And that ability to look and not see anything is actually very important in meditation practice. So, no origin, there's nothing there, that's just how it is. It requires a tremendous amount of acceptance, that part. Perception doesn't arise or vanish. When you make it more than that, it's like making form of what is formless. You lose touch with what is natural, how reactive you become. There is something wonderfully tenacious about the human proclivity to name an experience and then make an object out of that name. An academic word for this tendency is reification. But the proclivity has been known since ancient times. The opening lines of the Tao Te Ching point out how this propensity is problematic in the context of spiritual practice. And this is my own translation of the opening lines of the Tao Te Ching, not that I know any Chinese. A way that becomes the way is not the way. A name that becomes the name is not the name. When we are present, deeply present in what we experience, it is turtles all the way down. All of you know that one. Experience is groundless. When we look into that fathomless depth, we often recoil with fear. We feel as if we are jumping off a cliff into a bottomless abyss. Yet there is nothing to fear, because there is no bottom. There is no end to our fall. It is turtles all the way down, and we can fall forever. One of my favorite cartoons is, and someone sent me a version of this recently, shows two men, a dog, and a rooster. And the rooster is just all feathers, the dog's limbs are splayed, and his mouth is wide open. There are expressions of abject terror and horror on the two men. And the caption is, and the background is completely black. And the caption is, 3 seconds after falling into a bottomless abyss. The next cell is, the rooster's asleep, the dog's curled up, one of the men's reading a book, and the other is doing something or other, but is completely at peace. And the caption is, 3 months after falling into a bottomless abyss. Again, when we are deeply present, there is at the same time a nothing there quality. The nothing there quality can be likened to the space in a room. Yet even though we say there is nothing there, we are still aware. We know, but we cannot put any words to this knowing. And it's a different form of knowing. It's in one of the words in Buddhism is paramita, which literally means over there, you know, on the other side. It's a form of knowing which is different from ordinary human experience. It's usually translated to perfection, but that takes us completely in the wrong direction. We know, but we cannot put any words to this knowing. The knowing can be likened to the light in a room. We cannot say where the light comes from or what it is made of, any more than we can say where the space comes from or what it is made of. Beginning and end have no meaning when applied to the space and the light. They are just there, and that's how it is. So that gives you an example of how this is not a philosophical discussion. It's very much an experiential discussion. The aim is, as much as possible, to elicit, through the words of the poem, through the words of the commentary, to elicit some experience or some shift in you, and it is in those shifts that there is understanding. It's not through the conceptual process. which is why in the introduction to the book I say, read this and pay attention to what happens to you as you read it. Don't try to understand it per se. So with that, I'm going to stop talking, at least a little bit, and open it up for questions and discussion.
Questions?
Yes.
Can you give us just a little context on who this gentleman was, the time he lived, and where he fits into the Mahayana context?
Jigme Lingpa lived in the 18th century. He spent most of his time in retreats. He was a natural mystic, person of extraordinary talent, spiritual talent, and was in the Tibetan tradition known as a Tertön. A Tertön literally means a treasure revealer, and poems such as this would just appear spontaneously in his mind, and then he'd write them down. He is the author of a great deal of literature. The most famous cycle of teachings is the Longcheng Nyingtik, which is basically the backbone of the Nyingma tradition as it is practiced today in Tibet. Jigme Lingpa himself was regarded as the incarnation of Longchenpa, who was a very prolific and profound writer that lived in the 14th century, several hundred years earlier, who basically codified the teachings of Dzogchen, and then Jigme Lingpa supplied them with this this whole body of teaching, which is very alive and very vibrant and is the essence of what many Nyingma teachers transmit today. Does that give you enough context?
Yes, thanks.
You're very welcome. Other questions? Otherwise, we're just going to stare at each other like dead fish. Yes.
From what I understand, you and your organization have been trying to do this bigger translation of these practices into American 21st century culture.
No, I always believe in giving people plenty of rope. Keep going.
And so I'm actually very interested in your statement about the mysticism quality of Buddhism. How do you translate that into American culture?
Well, I'm moving increasingly in the favor of using the word mysticism, because I'm speaking personally here, but I know that there are people, friends and colleagues of mine, who feel the same way, that when we started off on this path, in my case, 1969, we knew what we were looking for, because we could not find it in the established religions in Western culture. The mystical components, except for a few remnants in the Catholic Church, had basically been beaten out of these institutions in the 19th century, logical positivism, for instance, and so forth. And they purposely buried all of their mystical stuff because they wanted to appear rational. So we knew what we were looking for, and we found in the various traditions of Buddhism methods of practice that put you in touch with a kind of knowledge or knowing, which was, you know, regarded differently in different traditions, but not, it was different from ordinary knowing. And for whatever reason, that is what we were interested in. We were not looking for it as a way to be more successful, because it certainly didn't work out that way. We were not looking at it as a way to solve our psychological problems, because most of us didn't even know we had any. That came later. We weren't interested in a purely scholastic or conceptual understanding. Now, the situation today, and I've had this conversation with several other teachers, is very, very different, because people who have a similar kind of calling now find themselves faced with a choice. They can either get involved with something which promises to help them in their lives, and I'm thinking of all of the stuff on mindfulness and how you're going to be more successful and less reactive and etc. The phrase that I hate here is doing well by doing good. I just bugs the hell out of me. And then on the one hand, or joining a religion on the other, because I'm probably being a little unfair, but I am a little unfair, so because the extent to which Buddhism has now become institutionalized and has developed many of the characteristics of the Western take on religion. Basically, you know, when I go to Buddhist teachers' conferences, they aren't Buddhist teachers' conferences, they're Buddhist ministers' conferences, because what the subject matter is, how do you manage a congregation? And there's very, very little, if anything, on actual teaching. And so you have a choice of either self-help and or utilitarian aspect, or join a religion. And then my friend and colleague Stephen Batchelor came up with this very unfortunate term, secular Buddhism. And this goes back actually quite a long way. He was inspired by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is an extraordinary theologian in Germany between the wars, who was eventually implicated in the plot to assassinate Hitler and was executed by the Nazis just a few weeks before the end of the war. But he was quite a remarkable individual. But he felt the same way about Lutheran Christianity, and so he was looking, so he came up with this idea of secular Christianity. And a friend of mine in Germany recently wrote a letter saying that, an email, we're having a conversation, he's saying, you know, we should talk about a secular mysticism. For better or worse, I pay attention to words, and I know what they're looking for. They're looking for something that doesn't fit any of those categories that I sketched out. And they're going on to the using this word secular, but it's just a terribly unfortunate choice as far as I'm concerned. So I think rather than go that direction, which just creates many, many problems, my feeling is we use the word mystical, because when you use the word mystical, it's not about improving your life. You know that. I mean, mystics do not have nice lives. Period. I mean, a horrendous number of them get killed, actually. If you look at the Sufi mystics and you look at the Christian mystics and even a few, I mean, Milarepa was assassinated. So, you know, they don't have good lives. So the utilitarian stuff just gets cut through completely. But it also differentiates it from ordinary religion, religion as a social institution, which is a very important part of society, but people like me are not interested in that. So that's why I favor using that term. But how to do it without stirring up a whole rat's nest of problems, I'm not quite sure, so I'm just going to see what happens.
How would you define your use? Do you have a definition or do you paint a picture of what you mean by mysticism?
Oh, heavens.
Can't hear the question back.
Do I have a definition of what I mean by mysticism? Well, here is the unfortunate position. You see, when I was in Vancouver in the early 70s, a friend of mine walked into my apartment and handed me his copy of Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations and said, read this, this is not negotiable. And I did. I found it intriguing and fascinating. What I didn't realize until many, many years later is that it completely changed my approach to language. One of the points that Wittgenstein makes in here is the meaning of a word is its use. I'm using mysticism and it's communicating something. Therefore, I don't need to define it. You get it. That's why it's unfortunate, because I'm not going to give you a concept. When I say it, it stops something and it communicates to you in a certain way, in the way that that I was trying to delineate in responding to her. That's how I'm using it. That's what it means to me. Okay?
That allows us to take it in any way we want to crystallize, though. Because it means one thing to me, it may mean something else to someone else in the room.
Well,
and I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm just commenting that we wind up creating our, as we always do anyway, our own worlds.
Well, we also create our own language. I mean, nobody here speaks English. Everybody speaks their version of English. Fortunately, they agree enough that we have the illusion of communication. There's enough overlap. But what's happened is that each of us has evolved our own version of English because we want to communicate. That's it.
Can I follow up with the issue of
just
language?
Once, because then there's a question behind you.
Well, because then with the, like when I practice something that says rest in ordinary mind, I have to say, well, what does ordinary mind mean? It's a translation. So I'm finding all the practices just leads you to your own experience in some way.
Well, this is a very deep question. One of the points that I did not make in my introductory remarks, but I should have, and you brought it up here, is that this is poetry, and the aim is to communicate an experience. One of my favorite examples is from Trungpa Rinpoche. There's a text called the Mind Training in 7 Points. And one of the lines is, the literal Tibetan is, during the day or when you're not meditating, be like a sorcerer. Juma Chebu Tabaja. Be like a sorcerer. Now, Trungpa, who is an extremely creative individual, completely reinterprets the Tibetan, which and gives what is a ridiculous reading, but comes up with the English. During the day, be a child of illusion. It's brilliant poetry because it communicates the experience immediately, even though it is very, very far from a correct translation. So, which is the correct translation? You had a question.
About the secular mysticism.
Yes.
And it seems to me, it sounds like that arises from an attempt by the logical intellect to circumscribe the mystical, which is totally inappropriate in my mind. That's what bothers me about it, at least.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. I don't. The people that are using that terminology, that's not where they're coming from. It's coming from a very, very deep yearning. I know these people, and they're looking for something which the ordinary language doesn't cover. But I find there's a secular primarily means non-religious. It's secular as opposed to religious, and so I think that or secular as opposed to spiritual, because then you have the other alternative, I'm spiritual but not religious, and that's not the same as mysticism either. That's something else. Okay, you had a question.
The pastor said that secularism was a triumph of Christianity.
Who said that?
Stephen Pastor.
Secular, well, Drucker, Peter Drucker.
So when you actually take it, when you live the life.
But he's using secular in a very, very particular sense, not as it's commonly used, and he's very clear about that. Right. You had a question. Woman in front.
Oh, I just wanted you to repeat that translation.
Oh, be a child of illusion. Okay. You had a question? Yes.
The notion that we all talk different versions of English, so they're different languages, is disturbing to me. Very, very disturbing. And I think it has to do with a mistake that we make in entering into relationship with words in the first place. And that if we are, that each, that there is a land, there is a ground, there is a place that has its own language, and if we arrive at that place together before we start talking, then we will find ourselves speaking the same language. But we don't make that effort, and so we're, it's like we're speaking from different countries.
Mm-hmm.
Different languages from different countries, and that is a fault, that is a failure. And if we only had been taught how to arrive in that land where we all speak the same language, it would be different.
I would agree with what you're saying, but I will make one slight change. Not if we had been taught, but if we had learnt. It's up to us to learn how to do that. It's not up to anybody to teach us.
I disagree.
Okay.
Because the learning and the teaching, they are two faces of the same event.
Not necessarily. You can learn things without ever being taught.
Oh.
And you can be taught and learn nothing. Well, teaching. My point is the learning is what's important, not the teaching.
So right now, as an example of this question of are the languages in the same country or not?
Exactly. Thank you. Yes.
I apologize in making an accusation here, by the way, Ken. You know that because you're a master of language, that we're being lost in language here. You began your talk speaking of this book, referring to an experience. Sigmund was interested in conveying an experience as best as he could in his beautiful poem. Yes, an experience. Could you please help us here recognize right now in this room the since this experience is not the result of training or practice or following that, it must be present here now in each one of us in some way. Is there any way for you to help us notice it directly right now, here?
Oh, Jeff, I'm going to leave that up to you.
It's for you. Make it more easy.
Make it more easy.
Make it more easy.
Mommy.
That's my challenge. Thank you so much.
Easier.
For some people, it is so easy.
I'm sorry?
For some people, it is so easy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of somebody like Urgen Tukul, for instance.
Oh.
Where, you know, this is just where he lives. I have friends who, you know, swim in the ocean or fly in the sky. And then for others of us, it's crawling on the ground. Let me say this. Your heart calls for something, right?
Yes.
And then there's nothing to do but to listen to your heart and go where it goes. You know, and where, in fact, that is basically what I say at the end of the introduction. If you're reading this book, you probably have a good bit of practice experience already. I suggest you read one or two verse commentaries at a time and see what resonates in you. Read them with a quiet, open mind. When you feel a shift, let it work inside you. Put the book down and rest right there, if only for a moment or two. When you sit down to practice, you may recall that shift. Do not think about what you have just read. That is just distraction. Do not try to go back to the shift or duplicate it. Simply rest in its echoes, in your body and your mind. In this way, these words may lead you into unknown territory, territory that is inaccessible to the conceptual mind. Where that may take you, what may become of you, I have no idea. I can, however, say this: no matter what the difficulties, no matter what the challenges, if you listen deeply to what calls to you in these pages and go where it leads you, I doubt very much that you will have any regrets. So that's probably a good note to close on. We're already at 8:30, I can't believe it.
Buy the book.
Buy the book. I do want to say one other thing about Nanny River's bookstore and bookstores like this. Amazon has been a relentless predator. The fact that there are several good bookstores in this area, and that Many Rivers has survived for so long, and it's really through your patronage, which is one of the reasons why I'm very, very glad to be here. So I urge you to buy books, if only to support Many Rivers Bookstore. Okay. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. That was wonderful. Please join me. Thank you. I am happy to take the echoes from this evening with me this evening. I hope you will take books and echoes as you exit. I will also point out that we have a donation bowl on the counter over there. We encourage you to contribute to it, as is our custom, half of which is donated to our guests, speakers, to further their work, half of which is retained to maintain the space for further such events. So this is what we're here for, this kind of discussion, these stones dropped, and, well, I'm mixing metaphors here, producing echoes. But okay, that's okay, I get to do that.
It's your birthday, you can
do whatever
you want.
It's my birthday, I can do whatever I want. So thank you all so much for coming tonight, it's delightful.
Thank you.